why did I write this book? Well, I've partly introduced that by saying I tend to pick people who are hugely controversial in their own time and have divided opinion ever since. And Mary certainly fits that bill, and Mary's certainly in a big double act with Elizabeth. I wanted to go back to original documents and to tell the story from the sources in an unprejudiced way. I suppose that's what everybody says that they want to do. But I really did do this, and there are probably, probably about 150 lives of Mary Queen of Scots over the years, and probably 1,000 articles. And I have to say that I did go back to the sources, and if I read into the secondary literature, I did it afterwards. It struck me, probably it strikes me more, having done two more since then on Margaret and Thomas More and Thomas Becket, that whereas in those cases the sources have either been partly forgotten, partly misunderstood, partly lost through the ravages of time, the Mary story is the only one where not only were there these huge difficulties of the sources, but in fact, actually, at the time, the equivalent of this sort of false paper trail had been laid down to mislead posterity, that sort of needed to be undercut. That was quite extraordinary. And actually, I mean, two people who appear in this, well, one who appears quite a bit in the talk, William Cecil, Elizabeth's chief minister, but also Walsingham's brother-in-law, Robert Beale, Francis Walsingham's brother-in-law, Robert Beale, actually created a special archive, which is now in the British Library, it wasn't in the Yorkshire papers, to preserve for posterity, if you like, their version of the Mary story, so that if you like, just as for Thomas Becket, you can go and look at Gilbert Folliot's, you know, if you like, brief account of the story, which is hugely rhetorically, it's a rhetorical success, but it's a total, you know, travesty of the truth. So Robert Beale's archive is actually, it's an archive, but it's a very, very partial and misleading one, however convenient it is. Because Mary said her story, her heart was her own, but I think it's certainly true that her story really never has been. And at the end, I concluded that she was as much the victim of the Executioner's Act, but also of the pen, that the pen had been just simply turned against her in her own lifetime. And the sources that were edited in the 19th century, particularly in the turn of the 20th century, were actually selected with a view to proving things about her. They were not selected with a view to actually looking at this in an objective way. I mean, I got into it, I'd be very candid with you, I got into it almost by chance, because I was actually working on, or thinking I was going to work on Elizabeth, and perhaps the last years of Elizabeth, which is actually what I'm going to do next. But the BBC were going to do something on Mary, and they called me up, as they do sometimes, and they said, you know, can you help us out? We're doing something on her, and we want to find the Carsky letters, and we've been to the public, as it's now called, the National Archives, it used to be called the Public Request, and they say they've lost them or they can't find them, which just means that they don't hire people anymore who know where to find these things. They hire people more for public relations and, you know, outreach and so on, rather than for actually reading these, you know, quite tricky sources. So, of course, I go down and I find them in about 10 minutes, which is exactly where they ought to be, which is where they're, you know, exactly how it is. And actually, just looking through the volumes, I was just absolutely amazed. It just hits you in the eye how much stuff was just there that had just been lost to posterity. We've just not seen it, and how much stuff, particularly with Cecil's annotations on it. And I thought, you know, this is a great topic, and I'm going to do it. So it sort of fell into my lap in a way that you would think that a subject like that had all been done, you know, 10,000 times. But, of course, if you do it from the same edited sources or the same books, you're going to get the same story, only if you look at something different or in a fresh way. So that's how it got, going. That is probably the classic Mary. By the way, that's a clue. That really is a clue. And that's Mary and what is called her Doyle Blanc, her mourning clothes after the death of Francis II. It was a picture that was, Nicholas Throckmorton, who appeared in the story, who was then ambassador to France, knew she had sent to Elizabeth as a gift. In fact, it's in the World Collection. Now, that's Mary essentially just before she comes back to Scotland in 1561. I mean, and remember that she's still just barely 18 at that time. Now, what do we think we know? What was it that we actually thought we knew about Mary? And one of the things that we think we know is that Mary ruled from the heart, whereas Elizabeth ruled from the head. And that's just etched into the literature. And, you know, I'm a bit of a fan of actually of Antonia Fraser, who, you know, was very nice about my book, and I know her, and, you know, we talked about various things, not just about Mary Queen of Scots. But that was something that, you know, she had got hold of, and it's just something that's always been, it's always been there. And actually, where does that come from? Because actually, that was actually something that was very much part of the story in the 16th century in a slightly different form. It's a, really what we know now is a sort of a spin. And it actually goes back to John Knox, believe it or not, who, just as, who of course was in Geneva, and of course, as one of the Marian exiles, he had been actually in England in Edward VI's reign. He'd even been offered bishopric in Edward VI's reign, believe it or not. He was quite in with William Cecil. He was quite in with the Duke of Northumberland. But he writes this book called The First Blast of the Trumpet Against the Monstrous Regiment of Women, which he publishes. He manages to publish it just as Elizabeth becomes queen, and it's on the streets of London just as his timing is really, you know, poor. But the essence of this book is that Marie de Guise, that's Mary, Queen of Scots' mum, who is the regent while she is in France, and Mary Tudor, Elizabeth's sister, who is the Queen of England, except that by the time this comes out, she's dead. They are Catholic women rulers who are idolatrous, and because they are Catholic women rulers, they are simply to be deposed, because a Catholic woman ruler, simply because they're Catholic, it's a wonderfully simple theorem, rules from passion and not reason, like Jezebel, or a failure in the Old Testament. We'll meet a failure again. And of course, a failure in and Jezebel in the Old Testament were both women rulers who were assassinated. And it says Knox that in a situation in which you have an idolatrous woman ruler who therefore must be a tyrant, tyrannicide is justified in the inferior magistrate, which is in England's case the Parliament, or in Scotland's case the Lords of the Congregation, are empowered to step in and deal with this. So already we've got the idea of Catholic woman ruler, because of Knox's Calvinist, as he is, since he's been in Geneva, a position is a Catholic woman ruler is somebody who rules from passion and not reason, i.e. from the heart and not the head, and then he carries it over, because Knox, I'm actually not Scottish, although I taught in Scotland, Knox in some ways is a little bit of a fraud, because he doesn't really want to go back to Scotland after Mary Tudor, he wants to come and live in England, he wants to send his sons to Oxford or Cambridge, and he has lived in England, in Edward's reign. You know, he was a friend of Bishop Hooper, and he felt out Cranmer because he was much more Calvinist than, in fact, Cranmer wasn't a Calvinist in that strict sense, because he liked order and decency, and he liked the razzmatazz of Desmond, even though he was reformed in theology. But anyway, Knox wants to come back to England, so he's got the TGV from Geneva, and he's got to Dieppe, and as it were, and he wants to come back on through Eurotunnel, you know, as it were, the Tudor Eurotunnel back to England. And, but of course, he's out of favour because he's written this book. Mm-hmm. And of course, he gets naturally, and this is all in the British Library. Again, you sort of fall over yourself when you stumble into this. He writes to Cecil, who's his chum, and he says, "How do I get back in?" Well, you shouldn't have written this book. Oh, no, well, but it doesn't apply to Elizabeth. It doesn't apply to Elizabeth because she's an exemplary woman. She's an extraordinary woman. She's a Deborah. She's not a failure or Jezebel. She's Deborah, a special woman, an extraordinary woman, an exemplary woman who's been sent by God to save the church and restore the church. The trouble is that, and that's where it gets interesting, Elizabeth, Roger, as I've discovered since I wrote the Mary book, Roger Ascham was the first person to try and spin Elizabeth as an extraordinary woman, an exemplary woman for her exemplary virtue, her exemplary understanding of languages and you know, in literature and, you know, humanistic studies and all of that. And really what that meant was that Ascham wanted to have himself broadcast through the world as an exemplary teacher who could, you know, bring up a student. You know, he was a professional educator who had a living to make. And although Elizabeth had talent, but perhaps not quite as much talent as a student as Ascham wanted. But Knox spins this line, no, she's perfect, okay, she's an exemplary. The trouble is Elizabeth didn't want that. And in fact, in the British Library, about 1563, there's a wonderful, almost like a sort of a chart of the arguments. It's probably done by, in fact, I'm almost certain it's done by Thomas Norton, who's a sidekick of Cecil, who's trying to figure out where these arguments lie. And, you know, we've got extraordinary woman, exemplary woman, sort of in the left-hand side, the right-hand side. No, Elizabeth won't have this. She does not want to be an exemplary woman. She does not want to be an extraordinary woman. There's a very simple reason, because it takes us to the heart of the whole thing. That she wants to be queen by dynastic right, like her father. She does not want to be queen on a Protestant ticket. Because the minute that you have a religious test as the basis of who can be a lawful queen, a test that is presumably going to be established by Parliament and the Protestant Parliament, you have transformed the monarchy. That is a view of the monarchy that Mary Queen of Scots believed, as I discovered in the Bibliothèque Nationale when I was reading about this. She talks to the French ambassador, Maubuissiere, about exactly the subject. She says that is a republican view. And I understand where she's coming from, because it implies exclusion. It implies exclusion by Parliament on the basis of religious test, i.e. it's a limited or constitutional monarchy, as we would say. Actually, it's exactly what happened in 1688-89, actually, when we chucked out James II and then brought in William of Orange and Mary. So Elizabeth won't have that she's an exemplary woman. But of course, for Knox, an exemplary woman, an extraordinary woman, rules from the head and not the heart. And this is really where this idea comes from. So it doesn't have anything to do, really, with whether or not Mary Queen, it's not an, as we might say, an empirical argument. It's not based on what they actually did. And again, we'll come back to that. It's based upon a theorem that was designed, you know, essentially by the radical Protestants to sort of exclude or get rid of Mary as the lawful queen. And actually, although it's not part of this talk, I mean, Elizabeth's reign really all the way through is riddled by this conundrum that, in fact, she does not want to be a queen by anything other than dynastic right. But, in fact, you know, other people, particularly the Protestants, who, of course, want her to be more Protestant than she is, want her to, in fact, to preside over a transformation of the entire polity in which the monarchy through the royal supremacy is turned into essentially a Protestant vehicle. Now, what else do we think we know? And that, by the way, you can see is here, that actually that's the illustration, one of the illustrations from another book by Christopher Goodman, again, on the same sort of idea. And you can see actually there Knox. It's a contemporary engraving. You can see Knox haranguing. Actually, Knox is haranguing Marie de Guise, actually, and Goodman is haranguing Mary Tudor. It's a rather handsome woodcut. We can see the first blast. You can see it's sort of almost like a first blast of a trumpet here too, and sort of like a herald. They're holding trumpets like heralds with heraldic banners on them, and blasting away. But what else do we think we know? We think that Mary and Elizabeth are cousins, rivals, queens. And I mean, books have been written on this subject: cousins, rivals, queens. Well, actually, if you look at this in any sort of objective way, and read what the people who one would perhaps most expect to be Mary's bitterest enemies on her return to Scotland in 1561, people like Maitland of Blessington, you know, the Secretary of State in Scotland, or you know the Lords of the Congregation, who are in effect the new government in Scotland, or certainly the new council for the most part. She's doing incredibly well, because of course when Mary comes back from France, she's behaving more like a Valois than a Guise. She's behaving more like a Politique than a Catholic ideologue. She accepts the Scottish Reformation. She does a deal with her half brother James Stuart, Earl of Murray, who goes to see her in France. She does a deal that if I can worship with my household in a private chapel at Holyrood or wherever in my palace in Stirling or wherever, then you can have your Protestant polity, and I won't. That's a very Valois, that's a very politique sort of solution. it's a solution that a lot of people in England would have liked if Elizabeth had married the Archduke Charles in the 1560s, actually, who was a Catholic or a sort of moderate Catholic, but William Cecil didn't want Elizabeth to have any sort of Catholic worship at all. Although Elizabeth actually, as I've again been discovering, could actually conform to Catholicism in quite a big way in Mary Tudor's reign. He didn't want any of that and probably wouldn't have allowed that. But the Scots allow this, and actually at the end of 1561, when Maitland of Lethington is writing a report to Cecil about how Elizabeth has been, Mary has been getting on, and he says, well, we're sort of astonished. I mean, she's so good that if there's any fault here, it's in us, not in her, because she is in fact taking advice. She's ruling as the Queen ought to do. She's taking advice from her, an unmarried Queen ought to do. She's taking advice from her counsellors. And we've actually got, we had all these fears and, worries, but actually it's all working out incredibly well. And in fact, Mary does incredibly well for 4 years. The first 4 years, up to 1565, she is extremely successful. And actually, contrary to what, you tend to read in books, Elizabeth actually, not by name, but basically regards her as her lawful successor should she die or marry and not have children. And we know this because in the progress of the summer progress of 1561, Maitland of Lethington actually comes south and the English court is on progress and this action in Suffolk. And Maitland of Lethington comes down and he writes a long report of this, the equivalent of a diary of everything that happens. And he says that, and he's talked to Elizabeth about this, and Elizabeth says, but Mary has the best possible claim. If I die without an heir, or I don't marry and have children, then she is the best person. And so, of course, what the offer is, the offer, and it's an offer that Mary has previously put to Elizabeth through Throckmorton, the offer is, I, as the Catholic claimant, if you like, will surrender my immediate claim to displace Elizabeth, i.e. to remove her. I will trade in my immediate claim for recognition as the first person in the realm, meaning your successor. That's a good offer. That is a good offer. And remember that Elizabeth is well disposed to be favourable to Mary, because Elizabeth is as angry as Mary that at the end of the English intervention in Scotland to boot out the French in 1560, which was entirely Cecil's operation, the Treaty of Edinburgh was signed between the English government via Cecil and the English representatives and the Lords of the Congregation without reference to Mary. In a sovereign treaty, she was cut out. And Mary would never ratify the Treaty of Edinburgh. Maybe that's a detail. But the fact of the matter is that Elizabeth knows that this is a good offer. And what stops it? The only thing that stops it is that Elizabeth has a super... Elizabeth actually says, I know no better title than that she has. And, of course, who are the English Protestants backing at that very same time? They're, of course, backing Catherine Grey. They're backing the Grey Line. Cecil is not just... You can ask the Anthony Lyon about this. He's not just backing the Grey Line, but of course Catherine Grey by this time, was obviously married Hartford and Beecham and so on, been put in the Tower, and they've managed to have two sons, even like Diana, she was able to produce an heir and spare in 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. And that's just what dynastic monarchy is all about. But Catherine Grey is in the Tower. Of course, Cecil is actually collecting her letters that are being sent to Elizabeth, her petitions to be let out to see whether it's particularly correct. Cecil is doing what Cranmer did during Henry VIII's divorce. He's sending a team, of whom Robert Beale is the chief member, all seems rather more, round the universities of Europe to get opinions that Catherine Grey is the lawful successor. It's an extraordinary divergence between Queen and Queen and Minister. And of course, where the Knox thing is concerned, of course, Cecil and Knox, again, this is sort of lost to history because you think, oh, Knox is a Scot and he's a sort of radical, and Cecil is, of course, an honest, law-abiding, loyalist bureaucrat. Actually, they were chums. And they're writing, Knox is writing to Cecil for the next sort of 25 years, so he pops his plot. And they're on the same wavelength. I mean, this is Cecil's view of Mary, that she's incredibly dangerous. But Elizabeth has this view that, yes, and she tells Maitland of Lethington, yeah, there's no better claimant than her, and if I die, she should have it. And he says, well, are you going to name her? No, I won't name her, because I'm not naming anybody. And this is where you have to separate two completely different ideas. Elizabeth will not name a successor by name, because she has a superstition about it. You know, I mean, I won't say it's a woman thing because I think it was much more rational than that. Actually, it's actually, you know, if you see what I mean, it's because it's often been said to be a woman thing, but actually I think it's much more rational because she knew that from her early experiences, particularly in Mary's reign, that if you start naming, or in Edward's reign, if you start naming the successor, then it will lead to plots. And this is exactly what Elizabeth said. If I name a successor, there'll be plots, and you know, we know how fickle the people of England are. They'll just be looking to the next one. And of course, she's dead right, because her own, if you like, inamorata, I mean Robert Dudley, an Earl of Leicester, by the way, throughout this story, is constantly keeping square with Mary Queen of Scots, all the way through. And even when she's under house arrest in England, and if you're going to Manor Lodge tomorrow, Sheffield Manor Lodge, even when she's at Sheffield, and he makes sure that he happens to take his, you know, 2 weeks summer holiday at the Buxton Spa, the same week that, you know, Mary's there, he's keeping his options. This is what happens. I think Elizabeth was quite right about this. She was quite sensible not to name, but of course it's not quite enough for Mary. By the way, in 1562, at the time of the idea of the meeting of the two queens, because they all could have met, and Elizabeth was willing to meet her, and actually it was not Elizabeth that cancelled the meeting, it was Cecil who'd written the press communique cancelling the meeting 2 weeks before Elizabeth even knew about it. And the meeting was only stopped because of the massacre of the Duke of Guise's forces, the Protestants at Bastogne. And then it was the French Wars of Religion get starting, so the meeting just didn't happen. But Elizabeth and Mary are very, very close. That's when they call each other sisters, they send each other gifts, they write each other verses. You know, of course, because they're both fully paid up members of the Woman Monarchs Trade Union. They both believe that dynasty comes before the religious test. And the fact that, you know, I wouldn't say there's a bit more than a cigarette paper between them, but the fact of the matter is that they are both people who are not Protestant. Well, I mean, Mary is a Catholic, but Elizabeth is not a Protestant ideologue. I mean, Elizabeth's religion is probably quite close to Catherine Parr's, actually. You know, she's a Protestant. Mm-hmm. She doesn't believe in certain theological things to do with, you know, the transubstantiation and so on. She's not a papalist. She's anti-papal. But the fact of the matter is she is not, if you like, a sort of full-blooded Puritan. Protestant. She's not the hottest sort of Protestant, which of course in Edward's reign, William Cecil actually had been to a great extent, and in fact in Elizabeth's reign actually he saw at the very, very beginning there's a wonderful book that's, you know, an academic book and sort of slightly obscure because it's not in the mainstream, but shows that actually Cecil was very happy to do without bishops in the Elizabethan church. He was quite happy to have no bishops. He was quite happy to go that way. There's not much. Knox and Cecil are much closer together on religion than Cecil is to Elizabeth, as you will see. Of course, I mean, there are blips in this relationship of Elizabeth and Mary, because of course Elizabeth does want to control who Mary marries. Mary, out there, a widow, and by the way, living hugely respectably and renowned for her discretion. I mean, in 1561, when she's coming back to England, Nicholas Throckmorton, the ambassador to France, is going spare at Elizabeth's, you know, bad reputation, of course, for sort of frolicking all night with Robert Dudley, you know, I mean, until the whole Amy Robsart thing sort of blows, and the scandal, and she has to sort of pull back a bit. But the fact of the matter is that it's the exact reverse of what, you know, people might have thought, that in fact in 1561, Mary is the virtuous woman. She's either married to first, second, or she's a widow. And it's Elizabeth who is living the risque, you know, this kind of scandalous life. But as I said, they were happy to meet. Only events in the French Wars of Religion come between them in 1562. And in fact, as late as, if we just leap on a little bit, as late as 1566, after Mary, if you remember, Mary has had her, by then Mary has had her baby, James, after she's married on, she's had her baby, and suddenly she has this gastric ulcer that bursts, and she is very, very ill after this ride from the Hermitage to Jedburgh. She's extremely ill, she's at death's door. She actually makes a will in which she leaves the custody of her young son, Prince James, to Elizabeth. And Elizabeth is greatly touched by this. And Elizabeth, in fact, she's touched by this, and the whole thing of this deal again revives, the trading in the immediate claim for recognition as the sitter. This comes back again. And in fact, one of the great teases, one of the great puzzles, one of the great mysteries about this is that offer that James would come to England and be put under Mary's, at Elizabeth's guardianship, triggers a new round of diplomacy in which Elizabeth and Mary are at the point of reaching a settlement woman to woman without regard to all these ghastly men around them. In Mary's case, you know, the Lords of the Congregation, or radical Protestant councillors, and in Elizabeth's case, you know, Cecil and his team, who she knows are plotting behind her back in the Great and in succession, and even in 1566 going as far as to put into the preamble of a tax bill, a subsidy bill, a tax bill, that getting the tax is conditional on Elizabeth marrying and settling the succession. By the way, which my wonderful former graduate student, who's now he's currently a lecturer at Cambridge, he's about to become the new professor at Leeds, and he went, when we were discussing this, I said, well, you really must go to the Parliament office and the House of Lords and look into this. And he goes down there, he discovers that the preamble to this tax bill was actually written in by William Cecil's secretary, who he got to be made secretary to the Parliamentary Committee doing the tax bill. Mm-hmm. So clearly the secretary goes to the committee with this clause written into, it memorized and then puts it into the bill. This is, very sophisticated political engineering, mm-hmm. which is going on here. And Elizabeth knew this was going on. So she agrees with Mary in this new round of diplomacy that James would come if she died. But if she lives, and this goes on, but in fact Elizabeth will, she's not going to name her as the successor. But she knows that she is, and she goes as far as to say that she will have a committee of judges investigate Henry VIII's will to see whether it was valid and whether it was legal. And what that means, of course, is that if a committee of judges investigated the will, they would discover it was not valid because it was not signed. The Third Act of Succession in 1544 said that the will had to be signed with the king's own hand. The will was not signed by the king's own hand. His will was signed with a stamp and inked in after he was dead. It was his will. It was not forged, as this doctor like, I think one or two historians have tried to say. It was not quite that, but it was not signed with the king's own hand. And, of course, in the court of law, remember that the judges are mostly Catholic. If you ask the judges, you're going to get a Catholic view. In fact, in 1566, while this is going on, at the beginning of 1567, Mary's ambassador, Robert Melville, has got his horses ready in the stable. He's got his luggage pack ready to ride to London the very next day to clinch this deal, to clinch this new treaty with Elizabeth. And that is the night in which the bomb goes off at Curtin Field and Lord Darnley is blown up. So then that's obviously that puts an end to that. But that's absolutely very interesting. The timing of that is extremely interesting. But to go back to where we were, Mary is incredibly successful, actually. I mean, her own councillors, the Protestants, there is no problem with Mary in those first 4 years. The problem comes when she decides to marry and marries Lord Darnley in 1565. Because the bottom line here, I mean, there's a very good reason for marrying Lord Darnley. I mean, she can't have Don Carlos because Philip won't let him go. Mm-hmm. And she wants to make why shouldn't she make a dynastic marriage? She's going to unite these two titles, to the English throne in this way. Darnley is one of these people who is capable of making himself incredibly personable for 6 weeks before it's true. He can behave for 6 weeks, before his true colours emerge. I think he was quite dashing and quite handsome, and she did like the look of him. Of course, Elizabeth wanted Mary. She wanted to control the marriage. She had this, and so much for Elizabeth running from the head and not the heart. She wanted Mary to marry Robert Dudley, her own, discarded lover, her own, and it was more than that, because actually he was, in a way, an unofficial consort. You're privy to what only I can tell you, that if you look in the Lord Chamberlain's Lord Chamberlain's accounts in the Exchequer records, you discover that obviously an unmarried woman ruler sometimes at state events needs a bloke. Just like if you were an unmarried woman or you're an unaccompanied woman, you sometimes go to a dinner and you need a, you know, I mean, not these perhaps so much these days, but you used to need a, you know, somebody with you. And you perhaps look for a bloke, or, you know, if you were an unmarried bloke, you'd look for a woman to go to this. In fact, actually, on those occasions when Elizabeth needed, a sort of pseudo consort, Dudley would move into the king's apartments, as well as into the queen's apartments at Whitehall. Elizabeth, of course, because she was the sovereign, lived in Henry VIII's king's side. Mm-hmm. But Dudley would move into the queen's side. It's absolutely true. He was a sort of unofficial, and this would have, he was a sort of unofficial consort. But Elizabeth wanted, she wanted Mary to marry, because that was the way to control Mary was to marry her off to a bloke. Because, of course, remember that rank does not trump gender in the 16th century. Only a couple of people in Italy, of whom Torquato Tasso was one, thought that rank would trump gender. If you are a woman ruler and you marry a bloke, within 10 minutes he will start saying he's the king. In a patriarchy starts to rule. Look at Jane Grey. Look at Jane Grey. And this is with loft to history until it re-emerged in the reports. And there's a manuscript by an Italian envoy coming through the Pope, Paul Commendone, who came to England and witnessed many of the events of the return of Edward's reign and the beginning of Mary's reign. And he tells us that when Jane Grey declared as proclaimed queen, Guildford Dudley, the new husband, comes and says, well, that's great, because I'm the king now. And she says to him, rather a woman of spirit, she says, no, you're not, matey. The most I'm going to do with you is make you a duke. And then says Commendone, well, in Guildford Dudley then says, well, in that case, I'm on a sex strike. No sex, no air. And he has to be talked out of it by the Earl of Pembroke. In fact, actually, the reign is too short, did it, for the state meaning. to anything. But, of course, the way that... And remember, this is what people had thought early in Mary's reign, before Philip was protecting Elizabeth. People had thought that the way to deal with Elizabeth was to marry her off to a non-entity. Mm-hmm. Courtney or whatever, put her under the thumb of the bloke and she'll disappear. It's the equivalent of, Henry II and Becket throwing me into a dungeon. She'll just disappear because rank does not, rank cannot trump gender. There's a lot, this is a, one wonders why one didn't sort of realise this, 30 years ago, but so it is. But, here's Elizabeth at the, really around this time. That's actually quite a flattering portrait, but she's got her knees under the table, she's in her stride, that's the cloth of his, it's a very sort of faded cloth of his fate at the back and the jewels at the side. It's a Stephen van der Merwen portrait, which is in the collection of Philip Murray, the art dealer of Dover Street, and I think you can buy it for £2 million if you like. You can't find anyone to sell it to at the moment. It's on temporarily on loan to Hampton Court Palace, but I can tell you that he's selling it if you want to acquire it. And that, of course, is Dudley, who was a handsome, very, very handsome man. But Elizabeth's idea is that Mary will marry Dudley and they will all live together in the palaces, the Tudor palaces in South England, and the Ménage à Trois.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, is this governing through the head or through the heart? This is an absolutely mad idea. And, of course, it particularly annoyed Mary because she didn't really think that she wants to be married off to Elizabeth's sort of discarded, love is not quite the right word, but and if you want to know what I think it's the reverse of Lewinsky and Clinton, basically. I mean, I think that basically, he did, but she didn't. I think that's really what it comes down to. I mean, they were very, very close, and as it was until people talked Elizabeth into basically behaving better. It was rather scandalous. So Mary decides, I'm not going to do this. And in fact, she can't have Don Carlos if she's going to marry. Where she wills, and she thinks, well, I'm going to marry Darnley. I can't get this deal. I've offered a great deal over the succession. I'm not getting it, so I'm just going to basically fortify my hand, and I'm going to marry Darnley. Of course, And by the way, you know, it was more than 6 weeks, actually. I mean, it was nearly sort of 4 months. And, I mean, when you think that actually Queen Victoria, you know, had Albert for, 2 weeks on approval, and she decided, you know, she could marry him, and, you know, Charles married Diana, you know, just having a couple of meetings. I mean, this is what they do. Mm-hmm. This is how royal marriages are arranged. It's often why they go so disastrously wrong, of course. Now, there were really three things, his darling. There were really three things that this marriage immediately triggered. Absolute resistance from Mary's counsellors, in particular her half-brother James Stuart, her legitimate half-brother James Stuart, Earl of Murray, Maitland of Lethington too. I mean, all of them. The problem is if you introduce a bloke into the situation and rank does not trump gender, they all have to reposition themselves against the bloke. And of course, Darnley, from the word go, decides that he's going to be king, and Mary, perhaps until she knows him better, of course, thinks that maybe he can be king, and then really within 2 days of the wedding says him he can't be king. Mm-hmm. And of course this and he wants to be known, he declares, he writes letters saying that he's king, he's addressed by the Catholic powers as the king, he believes that he's the king of Scots. What this does is it provokes a revolt. Murray leads a revolt. And Mary is very good at dealing with this. She basically puts on her armour, she gets on her horse and she leads her army and she drives Murray out of the kingdom. He flees into England. She triumphs here. You know, this is, it's not for nothing that Meryl Streep, you know, years ago, wanted to be Mary Queen of Scots and then put on her armour and get on her horse and, you know, chase. But I mean, it's absolutely true. Meryl Streep wanted to be Mary Queen of Scots for 20 years ago, really wanted to be Mary Queen of Scots in a Mary Queen of Scots movie, but it never came to pass because the thing with movies is that they require investors and investment. And, you know, this is sort of difficult. So nobody quite wanted to that just never came off. And Mary recovered from that. But of course, the other big thing about this marriage is that, of course, it, in a dynastic sense, I mean, Mary learns that Darnley is basically incredibly vain, selfish. He has lots of affairs. He gets syphilis. He's a thoroughly difficult character. He misbehaves when he's told he can't be king and sort of start plotting. But dynastically, it's a great success because, of course, she has Prince James, you know, really sort of, mm-hmm. you know, within the year. And, of course, this absolutely terrifies William Cecil, who sits up at night writing as he does. This is why he's so wonderful to study, of course, because he sits up late at night and, you know, writes it all down. He says, the people of England will flock to her because she has married and settled succession. This is what Arkwood ought to have done. I've been trying to get her to do it, but she won't do it. She's married and she's settled in succession, and the people of England will flock to her. She is so incredibly dangerous. And this puts a completely different take on what you thought you knew about Mary's sort of popularity in England. The fact of the matter is, and he even has a map in which he draws all the houses of the, you know, the sort of the Catholic gentry in the North England. Mary was, it is not true that, I mean, the English Reformation was a very half-baked sort of thing. I mean, yes, Henry was very successful in kicking out the Pope. But if you ask the people, this is what Robert Parsons said in the 1590s, of course, if you ask the people of England what religion they have, they all say they want to be Catholics, or many of them. It's really only in London, the South East, certain places where the Protestants are amusing. The Protestants are like the Bolsheviks in 1917. They're quite few in number, they're quite radical, they're quite organised, they're even armed. You know, this is dangerous. And it's at this point that Cecil is determined to basically, if he wasn't determined before, to get rid of Mary, whom, by the way, he cannot address by, this is the other extraordinary thing about the archives. There must be probably, you know, 5,000 references in Cecil's papers to Mary Queen of Scots. He never once calls her Mary. He can't even call her. He sometimes calls her the Scottish Queen. Most of the time he calls her SQ. He can almost only know her, name her by an acronym. Do you see that? I know it's quite old now. You see that former American Beauty? You know, there was that realtor who sort of does this dance sort of Japanese style, you know, sort of corporate dance every morning, a song every morning, you know, I've got to sell a house today. Mm-hmm. Cecil gets out of bed, so I've got to cut off the head of the Queen of Scots. You know, she is the enemy. And that is not really so with Elizabeth. Anyway, Murray rebels, and we've got his Murray. He wanted to be king. Only illegitimacy stood between him and the throne. He was a bloke. There's no doubt that in the 16th century, a woman monarch is hugely problematic in a whole variety of ways. Possibly a woman regent might work for a bit, but a woman monarch is, look at Mary Tudor, that I only discovered really when I started doing something on children who gave the moment when Mary Tudor first became queen. And she had a lawful claim from Henry VIII's will. Her own council, her own advisors in her own, the staunch Catholic lords in her own household, they all thought she should be confirmed as queen first by Parliament because she was a woman. She wasn't just going to get it. It's absolutely extraordinary, the mindset of this stuff. You have to reimagine that mindset before you can sort of start to get your head around this. It's actually, you know, from 21st century audience, you know, you just automatically don't just get your head around this the first time. But he wanted to be king. But anyway, he rebels, and you know, he's driven into England, where he's now in exile. So Mary has basically got it back together. So a year later, they kill her secretary Rizzio. They plot and they kill her secretary. You know, quickly in front of her eyes, they stab him. However many times, you know, in front, and you know, again, you can still see the pool of blood. There's still the blood staying on the floor in the chamber, and except I'm afraid it was painted on again in the 19th century. But I mean, you can still see it is absolutely extraordinary to go into that suite at Holyrood. I know it's been sort of refixed by the Victorians, but the architecture of the rooms is exactly the same. You can still see the secret stairs where Wilfrid and the rest crept up. You can see Mary's supper room, you can see the great chamber, you can see the big staircase where they create. It's absolutely extraordinary. The Scots have still got their, you know, palaces more or less, you know, in the state that they were, without so many changes in the 16th century. Of course, why did they kill Rizzio? Well, because essentially, after the rebellion against Mary, when she marries Darnley in 1565, basically, Mary has it that Parliament, the Scottish Parliament, is going to confiscate the lands of the rebels. And the rebels are effectively the Scottish lords who think they are calling the shots. And they make a deal with Darnley that they will recognise him as king if he stops Parliament from confiscating their lands. And they tell him, to sort of spice things up a bit, they tell him that Rizzio is sleeping with Mary, which I think is really completely untrue. That's how that, but Darnley is fooled by this. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the thieves and villains fall out, and then Darnley, you know, falls out with the law, until a year later they murder him. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Mary has recovered from the rebellion. She's recovered from Rizzio's murder. And by the way, at the time of the Rizzio murder, she was basically heavily pregnant, and she basically rides, you know, through the night and so on. She's an amazing woman, this woman, actually. She's an amazingly resilient woman. She's tough. I suppose her Achilles heel is that she's had, a pampered, but I suppose it was a bit pampered, but she's not had the struggle to get to where she was that Elizabeth had. Mm-hmm. And therefore, she's sort of had it on a plate, and she's sort of more easily step back when things go wrong, whereas we're sort of expecting things to go wrong all the time. And also, Mary is one of those. I can tell you this little insight that I think is just actually quite revealing that you sort of pick up when you've done, you sort of really sort of got to the bottom of it all. People are different, and Mary's one of those people. If there's a problem, she wants to fix it. If there's an issue, she wants to step in. She's one of those people that is proactive, wants to deal with it, because Elizabeth is always going to delay. Elizabeth will never decide anything. If there's a problem, she'll just leave it and hope that, you know, it will go away. That's the difference between them. But anyway, they kill Rizzio's secretary, and she deals with that. She sort of copes with that. And then they kill her husband in a gunpowder plot because, as I say, Darnley becomes absolutely impossible and threatens to go abroad and claims to be king and wants to have a Catholic invasion of Scotland and, you know, all the rest of it. So they kill him in a gunpowder plot. By the way, was Mary involved in the gunpowder plot, forget it. Mm-hmm. Did Mary have a plan to deal with Darnley? Undoubtedly. And it was to take him to Craig Miller Castle and put him under house arrest, basically, and just basically lock him up and, you know, forget about him. And psychologically, that totally worked. What does not work psychologically, would you kill him in a gunpowder plot? As a, especially if he is king, which he probably isn't, but if he thinks he's king, it's for regicide. It's in a gunpowder plot in front of the whole of Europe. I mean, it's just, it's totally destabilizing. If you want to get rid of him, if you want to get rid of him, you poison him quietly. This is the whole thing. You don't kill him in a gunpowder plot. So it just doesn't add up. But of course, that is difficult to overcome. The destabilization that causes is impossible to overcome. And of course, we've got, this is the this is the detail from the image of here's Darnley. This is of course very much a very much a Lennox inspired drawing of Darnley lying dead in the garden at Kirkfield over the wall, and little Prince James praying, you know, judge and revenge my cause, oh Lord. Of course, totally fictional, but there you go. And of course then, of course, what happens is what we all know, that Mary takes Bothwell as her protector. James Hepburn, Earl of Bothwell. And here he is, who, of course, has recently married Jean Gordon. But actually, this is not a stupid thing to do, to take Bothwell as her protector. Where else is she to turn? She knows that she knows then, I mean, she's under, I kind of agree with Antony Fraser, she's under great psychological stress. You know, where is this going to go? That's what they do in Scotland. This is what Margaret Tudor had done after James IV was killed in battle. This is what she does. She takes the Earl of Angus as her protector. But as with Bothwell, again, you know, these ambitious blokes, they exact the price of protection in his marriage. But actually, Bothwell, you know, who is Bothwell? Yes, he is a Protestant, but he's a Scottish nationalist in the sort of in a special sense that I mean, meaning he's anti-English but pro-French. And he, of course, has been Marie de Guise, Mary de Guise's most loyal supporter. It was Marie de Guise whom Bothwell was raising troops for, collecting money for, against the Lords of the Congregation, against Murray. When during the revolt of the Lords of the Congregation in 1559, William Cecil is without Elizabeth's knowledge, smuggling bags of gold across the Scottish border to fund the Scottish Revolution. It's Bothwell who steals the money. And the Lords, Murray, never forgive him for this. Bothwell, by the way, is solvent. He's the Lord High Admiral of Scotland, so he's entitled to the proceeds of all wrecks off the Scottish coast. He's got an army because he's got he's at the centre of a network of border lords. The only other person who can raise an army on that scale is the Earl of Argyll. He's not an implausible candidate. He was educated at the University of Paris. He's one of these people who's got a rough side and a smooth side. Yes, he could be a brute. Yes, he could be, you know, cheap and all of that, and he did treat Mary at times quite badly once, you know, he got so with these under the table. But he also could have great polish. You've only got to look at his handwriting. His handwriting is absolutely amazing. It's absolutely beautiful Italian cant. This was a man who clearly had style and, you know, polish as well as, you know, the other side that we perhaps know that we know better. And so Mary takes, you know, where is she to turn? The one man in Scotland, the one lord in Scotland who's solvent and can do something in the Heston force, who'd been loyal to her mother, is Bothwell. But of course, then he demands the marriage, and, you know, and he actually, you know, as you know, he intercepts Mary on the way back into Edinburgh and takes her, you know, takes her off to his castle at Dunbar. And I have to say, I think, although it's might be controversial, but I say that he talked, rather than raping her, he talks her into bed. Although rape was quite an established way of staking your claim in these circumstances. I had not realised till I did this bit before. The reason that Eleanor of Aquitaine married Henry II so jolly quick after her divorce from Louis VII is that about seven people were planning to set her and rape her on the way back to Aquitaine in order to stake their claim. So it's not just a Scottish thing. But of course, once Mary has married Bothwell, of course, the same problem kicks in that we've had with Darnley. The blokes, the lords, cannot relate to the new, you know, Bothwell wanting to be king. So again, they thought that the Bothwell, who clearly has been involved in Dahmer's murder, and there's no question about that, he probably played quite a prominent part in the whole thing. Who was the mastermind? Well, you know, this is not quite what, exactly what we know, although it's very significant, I think, that James Stewart, Earl of Murray, knew not to be there on that exact night, because, you know, basically his storyline was that his wife, Agnes Keith, was about to give birth on the other side of the Firth of Forth, and of course that meant you had to go round by Stirling. There was no Forth Bridge then, so you had to go the long way round. But he knew not to be in town on the night. And Sir Bothwell was not the mastermind, but he was certainly involved, and this became clear to Mary, I think, after she had married him. But anyway, the same thing happens again, and the lords basically step in and they confront Mary and Bothwell at Carbery Hill, and, you know, I mean, the rest is, as they say, it's history. Now, just for a minute for you, because I think that one of the things that you like in, perhaps I think you will like in these talks, is to sort of go backstage and see something from behind the scenes. And you probably can't read it, especially from this distance, but you can see it's a rather splendid letter from Elizabeth, written on the 28th of February. It says 1565, but then the new year began on Lady Day, so it's 1566. This is actually written just before Rizzio's murder, and it's a letter from Elizabeth. It's a pretty bit of a stinker to Mary. It's a bit of a stinker, saying, "I want you to take Murray back into Scotland. Stop messing about. Just take him back." Of course, Elizabeth didn't really want Murray in Scotland, but of course Murray particularly wants to get back because he doesn't want Parliament to confiscate his lands. So he's got a big incentive to get back. And you think, actually, this is a bit of a sort of bummer, because, if I can use that word, of this company, because it sort of seems to undermine my claim that, you know, here we've got sort of cousins, more sort of sisters, queens rather than cousins, wives, it's queens. But actually, I don't think it does, because this letter turns out to have been written from beginning to end by William Cecil. That's the draft of it, and Elizabeth simply signed it. And of course, it's Cecil that wants Murray to go back into Scotland very urgently, because of course he's on his side. But another thing about this that doesn't add up. It's a beautiful letter. It's in absolutely great nick, and it's in the National Archives, and doesn't that in London? And doesn't that raise a question? Because I didn't think at the first, and then I suddenly thought, why is this in the National Archives? And then, of course, I looked into the whole situation, the whole context of this letter. And I can't tell you, because you can see it just before Rizzio's murder. This letter, there's correspondence about it. This letter, which Cecil had drafted, there he is, Cecil, you know, the man of the loyal bureaucrat, as it might seem, with his wand of officers. That's actually done while he's Lord Treasurer, so that's a little bit later, because he's not Lord Treasurer until 1570. This letter is written and it's sent, and of course it goes up the equivalent of the A1, the Great North Road. It goes up to Berwick-on-Tweed. Now, one of the things, actually, when we were talking about the Men Four Seasons, actually, remember there's a servant called Patrick, and he sort of, when the letter comes, he has a sort of peep, and he knows. This is one of the extraordinary things. These letters were all sealed, and yet the servants, you know, always knew what was in them somehow. But this letter of Elizabeth, this very same one, goes up the Great North Road and it goes to Berwick-on-Tweed. And the captain of Berwick-on-Tweed says, "Oh, you don't need that. You won't need that. Murray will be back in, you know, a couple of weeks. Rizzio is going to get popped." You know, they all knew. They all knew that Rizzio would be dead. They all knew about this. So the reason the letter's in London is it was never delivered. It was sent back to London. That's why it was, you don't, of course, no one told Elizabeth. But, of course, it goes back with a note saying to Cecil, "Don't worry about this, because Rizzio will all be held in Scotland in, you know, a couple of weeks' time, and Rizzio will be dead." And then, you know, then Mary will welcome her brother back with open arms. Which, of course, so, I mean, it's a sort of smoking gun. I mean, they don't tell Elizabeth. She's sort of cut out of the picture completely. So, you know, this all starts to form a bit of a... This starts to form a bit of a pattern. And, by the way, I now... I think it's very, very likely that that letter was probably never opened until the 19th century, when the archivist started arranging the papers. It was probably just sent back and just dumped in a box or in a file, and probably opened by archivists in the 19th century. when they come into the state papers. And that's, as I say, that's Cecil's draft. But I then that is obviously typed. You get some idea of the mindset here. Again, this is 1565 rather than 1564 for the same reason that the year began. The New Year is considered to begin with the number. It's considered to begin. New Year's Day was on the 1st of January, but the year day didn't change till Lady Day, which is the 25th of March. In this letter of January 1565 from Cecil to Archbishop Matthew Parker of Canterbury, which is in the Parker Library at Corpus Christi College, Cambridge, Cecil writes, "It may please your grace, I do send here with a form of a letter." That means a draft, it means a template for a letter, a form of a letter, which at the beginning to write the same, "I thought should have been meet to have procured from the Queen's Majesty to your grace," i.e. I'm writing the letter that's going to be signed by the Queen and sent to you. But after that I have caused it to be new written, I mislike the same treaty for length, but yet before I would alter anything, I thought meet to remit it to your grace's consideration, praying the same to alter and abridge any part thereof. The next doubt I have is whether the Queen's Majesty will not be provoked to some offence that there is such cause of reformation, whether she will not have more added than I shall allow. Upon your grace's correction hereof, I will follow your advice. I mean, what a letter. What it means is, I'm drafting a letter that the Queen's going to send you next week. I think it's a bit long, so we might cut it a bit, but I thought before I actually did the final version, I'd send you it to see whether it's what you want to get at your end, and if not, tell me. Basically, we'll just sort of fix it up and send it to you. The only thing I'm a bit bothered about is because it's a bit too hot on the Reformation. She might throw a wobbly, and more than I will allow. But what a mindset. I mean, who's running the country here? It's not for nothing. It's not for nothing that the trouble is he's not quite respectable. There was a very famous 19th century historian called James Anthony Froude, who wrote the history of England, from the time of Wolsey to before the Wolsey to the defeat of the Spanish Armada, who actually started, and he'd used the archives in St. Mary's quite because he knew the state. For his age, he was an amazing guy, those Victorians, they just read him. But he would just talk about King Cecil, as if Cecil had sort of almost usurped the throne. Well, I think that's maybe going a bit far, but that's a fascinating quote, isn't it? Whether or not she will have more added than I shall allow. Well, Mary was not a battle of Carver, after the confrontation of Carberry Hill. Of course, Bothwell fled to Denmark, and Mary was taken to Lochleven, and she was put in prison under arrest at Lochleven. And she was forced to abdicate, as you know. Of course, Elizabeth was absolutely apoplectic about this. This, she said, was much worse than whoever killed Lord Darnley, even though, of course, Lord Darnley was her cousin. Relative. This was worse than whoever killed Lord Darnley. An anointed queen, a queen anointed by God, being chucked out by rebellious Protestant lords. This is too much. So, of course, she sends for Sir Nicholas Throckmorton, who is this guy here. Sir Nicholas Throckmorton, who is the Henry Kissinger of the 16th century. He was a cousin of Catherine Parr, and he'd a very interesting career, actually. He was known to Cecil, and he was on good terms with Cecil. He was probably more Leicester's man than Cecil's man, actually. But he was a very experienced diplomat, because he'd been the same one who'd been in France while Mary was married to France II, and then after when she was at Riddell. He was the same one, of course, to whom she'd first put in France the idea of this deal, this trade, and the child trade, and the immediate claim for recognition as the successor. And Elizabeth sends Throckmorton to Scotland, to Lochleven, to try and see Mary, and his instructions are from Elizabeth: get her out, get her restored, get her put back on the throne, that's what you have to do. She's an anointed queen. Throckmorton never does see her, although Mary manages to smuggle out a letter with a message for Elizabeth. You can see it signed here by Mary, and it's sort of smuggled out. It's addressed to Throckmorton. It basically says, I'm a celebrity, get me out of here. And on a tiny bit of paper that because you've got to see the slides, you can't tell the internet site. It's on this very small piece of paper, sort of written. It's written very, very, very close. You can see from my prison in the tower at Lochleven. So anyway, Throckmorton goes north. Of course, he's got his instructions from Elizabeth. Cecil gives him completely different instructions. Cecil's instructions are, she's in prison, keep her in, don't let her out. If she is let out, she's not to have any money, she's not to get back together with Bothwell, she's not to be a proper queen, she's to be basically a sort of, if you like, this sort of figurehead, and Scotland's to be ruled by a council of 24 Protestant nobles. Of course, Throckmorton can't square this. I mean, he can't serve, both Elizabeth and Cecil here, and this actually destroys his career. Yeah. Because he can't satisfy Elizabeth, he can't satisfy Cecil, he can't tell Elizabeth that he's totally told his about Cecil, he can't tell Cecil that he's told his about, but he can't use it as a reason for not to be. He's stuck, basically. And of course she doesn't get out. But there's also something that's hugely interesting that really this was probably of all the things that I found, this was the new recount. It doesn't look much, does it? It's the right-hand side. This bit here. It doesn't look much, does it? This side of it, which you can't see, but that side of it is Cecil's instructions to Throckmorton, what he's to do. Mm-hmm. That, at the end, is a little note. A failure for Reg, interrupter for Joash Raven. Well, obviously it's in Latin. Obviously, for Reg refers to the books of Kings and Chronicles, which were not called Kings and Chronicles then. There were not two books of Kings and two books of Chronicles. There were four books of Kings. It's a biblical quotation. You can look it up. It's absolutely there. It's the passage from the book of Chronicles that says that Athalia was assassinated so that Joash could be king. It's exactly the same ticket that Knox has in the first blast of the trumpet against the monster regiment woman, that Athalia is a Catholic woman ruler who can lawfully be assassinated. And he's just jotted it. It's not part of Throckmorton's instructions. It's just he's finished the thing. It's his, if you like, it's almost his subliminal. It's his subconscious speaking. But he can't resist writing it down. He just can't write it to Rudder. And of course, remember, who's Joash? He's like Josiah. He's basically a little boy who becomes king. And of course, the government is carried on by basically a council of regency. What Cecil's looking for is to basically have Mary written out of the equation, and the Scottish laws that he's always so concerned to keep in power, these Scottish Protestant laws, shall be the council of regency for Prince James. But you're looking right inside the head of the assassin. A failure was assassinated so that Josh would be king. He's already foreseen there. And we're only in 1567. We're actually not in 1568, we're in 1567. Anyway, Mary's in Lochleven. As you know, she gets out. She escapes brilliantly. I mean, she's resourceful. She escapes across the Solway Firth. She gets to Carlisle Castle, which is this image. And she basically, naturally, wants to see Elizabeth. And Elizabeth is thinking about it. Of course, Cecil says absolutely not. She's to be locked up. She's taken to Golden Castle. She's put under Sir Francis Knowles, who's a hotshot Puritan. Of course, Elizabeth, etc. So, you can imagine the story. And of course, Cecil then works with the Scottish laws, Protestant laws, to put Mary in what's effectively on trial. Not the final trial, but if you like, the first trial, the trial before commissioners. First commissioners, the Duke of Norfolk and so on. And by the way, they look into this and they, was Mary guilty of implication in Darnley's murder? And the first commission is just about to report, well, no. And Cecil says, no, you're fired. We're having a new commission. And he's on it. And people who are going to find a different way are on it. And this is the one that finishes up meeting at Hampton Court. And they look into the whole story. And of course, the Scottish Lord Murray and the Lord Scottish Lords come south. And of course, they bring this dossier, the original set stuff dossier. The dossier that includes the case for the prosecution, which was worked up for Lennox, for Darnley's father, The Other Planet by George Buchanan of St. Andrews University, the Protestant Baptist College in St. Andrews University, who of course is been a Calvinist and has actually been married. He's actually read Latin verse and Psalm with Mary while she was in happier times, while she was queen. But now he's gone over. He's Lennox's client, basically. He's been paid by Lennox. But he writes this dossier, and this dossier includes at the end the famous casket letters allegedly found in Bothwell's chamber in Edinburgh Castle, the so-called casket letters. The originals, of course, the original actual letters, which were French, mostly in French. The original letters have disappeared. They were after this hearing. They were given back to Murray, who took them back to Scotland. At which point, they probably disappeared. As well, they might. They are now known through copies that essentially Cecil made while they were in London, and which he annotated, and which are now divided between the National Archives and Hatfield House, where a lot of the Cecil papers are the papers of the Marquess of Salisbury. And they include the one that begins here, the long Glasgow letter. The casket letters is a big topic, and it's challenged generations of historians. And I think the first thing to say is that they simply can't possibly be read at face value because they don't add up. This Glasgow, long Glasgow letter is like Anne Boleyn's indictment. It doesn't work. Mm-hmm. She wasn't in those places at those dates, and mm-hmm. even if she'd done what was said she was done, it couldn't have been in that way. And this is the problem with these letters. Also, they just simply don't ring true. Antonia Fraser had a solution that depended on the work of an historian who had written just before she did her biography called Davidson, and he had a theory that this was a set of letters that had been written to Bothwell by another woman completely, neither his wife nor Mary. But actually, I don't think that holds water. If you read these letters closely, they make a huge amount of sense if they are genuine letters that Mary wrote to Darnley. And, of course, they include lovers' tiffs and all the rest of it. They make enormous sense in terms of dates and places and facts and what we know. And also the psychology of that relationship. It makes perfect sense if they were letters written to Darnley that had been discovered in Edinburgh Castle, but which had little bits added to them, and the pages sort of shuffled about. This is my solution. Why would they need to be primarily Mary's letters? Because Elizabeth wasn't stupid. There was a handwriting test. Mm-hmm. They got genuine letters that Mary had written to Elizabeth, and they were put on the table. Mm-hmm. And it was a bigger table than this, because by the end there were about 20 odd commissioners, and they were all sitting around the table at Hampton Court. And actually, they were the handwriting examination was sort of afternoon. You can see how they were looked at, but they weren't looked at forensically, over a lengthy period by any one person. And it makes perfect sense, but that is the only thing that really makes perfect sense, that these letters were genuine letters that had been doctored. And also, in these letters, there are strange, even in the transcripts, there are strange gaps between them, and then there are awkward jumps, in the film, before awkward jump cuts, where it would make perfect sense to think that these letters have been rearranged in this way. And so that is my explanation of the casket letters. And Elizabeth clearly did not believe that this was a genuine story, because what she did was she just basically drew it to a halt. She believed that the case was, as the Scots might say, at best not proven in Scottish law today. She was not found guilty. Mary was not found guilty. The thing was stopped, and Elizabeth swore everybody to secrecy. So how is it that we know about the casket letters? How is it that we even know about them? And how are we looking at that in which they appear in print? Well, because 3 years later, in 1572, which of course was a very tricky year with the massacre of St. Bartholomew, of course, in Paris, and the Protestants afraid, and of course the Northern Rising had occurred in 1569, but in 1572 there's Parliament, and Cecil makes his bid to get Mary executed by Act of Parliament. Not just excluded from the succession, but executed by Act of Parliament. And Elizabeth vetoes it. With an attempt to get it through, Cecil, and now this is now clear to me, explained in the book, Cecil, unbelievably, it's sort of, you heard of Alistair Campbell or Peter Mernius, and, you know, I mean, sort of an experienced modern political operators in Whitehead, in the Labour, the new Labour government, who were masterminds of spin. He gets these letters printed as, we'll come back to that one, he gets them printed as an appendix to Buchanan's dossier for the prosecution, and he issues them in the equivalent of brown envelopes to his assured friends who are going into the Parliament so they can read it first and they do their homework and then quote from it in the Parliament, which people like Thomas Norton do. He has it printed, but he's clever. It's translated, it's all translated out of French into phony Scots. And it's done as a detection of the doings of Mary, Queen of Scots, touching the murder of her husband and her conspiracy, adultery, and pretended marriage with the Earl of Bothwell, and the defence of the true laws, that's the Protestant laws, maintainers of the King's grace, that's James VI, action and authority, translated out of the Latin. Well, the original dossier was in Latin, but the copy letters, which are appended to mostly in French, translated out of the Latin, which was written by GB. And you can see they don't put an Edinburgh colophon on it, but you can see it's meant to be. Actually, this was all cooked up by Thomas Wilson, who was Cecil's chum. And he wasn't a Scot and didn't really know. It's not in proper Scots even, yes. It's a bit of a laugh. And it wasn't printed in Edinburgh. And it was nothing to do with George Buchanan. He was absolutely outraged that, you know, his name had been taken here. GB is to George Buchanan. I didn't like this. And actually then Cecil writes a book called A Copy of the Letter, which he writes under a false name, in which he claims that, as he printed and claims that Buchanan had given his authority for it, which is not really true, because all Buchanan had done was write the dossier for Leonard, the case for the prosecution for Leonard, which had been appropriated to him. So this is actually a stitch-up. This is a stitch-up. This is not just something that's printed. This is a stitch-up, but it's a stitch-up designed to trigger, you know, if you like, a reaction of the, and Cecil sent it to his assured friends, which means my Protestant friends, my network, my political chums, to get this done. And if you go back, this is the print of the letters. You can see them again. It's in French, and then it turns into that one. Then it turns into sort of Scots, and then you can see there's a sort of bit of a summary of it there. And then you go into that one was written in Scots. Actually, the original letter of that last one was written in Scots in the begin with. But this is the back. This is the back of one of Cecil's copies of the Long Glasgow letter. And there, this one has been turned into English. But can you see these little marks? E and K. All of them have these symbols on the back, and these are cues for the printer to set these up in the type, in the detection. So what you did then, you didn't write it all out for the printer, they could read this stuff. You gave them a running order, like a route map, with these symbols, and now this one and then that one. These are keys to how this all works in some sort of database inside Cecil's head. You know, he's absolutely behind. He's absolutely behind. And we know this is done by today. It's done by Thomas Wilson, who's his sidekick. This is done to basically frame, it's leaked to frame Mary with what should have been kept secret, basically destroy her reputation. And of course, she knew that she would live or die, really, not by what she'd done, but by her reputation. Mm-hmm. It took Cecil another 15 years to get Mary executed. Elizabeth just didn't want to do it. This is not the original warrant, because the original warrant was undoubtedly destroyed after the event. But it's the next best thing. This reappeared out of the private collections, which had originally been in the papers of the Earl of Kent, who was one of the commissioners at Fotheringay on the day, and this was in his back pocket on the day. It's a copy that was sent of the warrant that was sent to him personally. I do not think that Robert Beale, who was sent before Warren, ever lit it out of his possession. And after the deed was done, and he went back, I'm absolutely sure that I can't prove that Elizabeth had the thing destroyed, the warrant destroyed, because her signature was on it. But this is a copy that Robert Beale did, and you can see that Robert Beale was so terrified in making this copy that he didn't copy Elizabeth's name properly. He spelled it in the contract. He spelled it with a Y, and the S is different to her, the Z is different to her Z. Why? Because the forged Queen's signature was a felony and therefore a hanging offence. So he gave this thing to the Earl of Kent. I'm awfully proud of this because it's now in the Lambeth Palace Library, but I was able to be. I was the expert advisor on the Committee for the Export of Works of Art, which advised the Secretary of State for Cultural Media and Sport not to allow it to be sent abroad out of the country. And so it was saved for the nation. And it ended up in Lambeth Palace. As I say, it's not even the best text, actually. At the committee, the British Library in Rotterdam, from this being recorded, so I'm going to be careful. At the committee, the British Library struck and displayed its hand because it tried to argue the best possible text, and the appellant who wanted to do the report knew very well it wasn't the best possible text because he'd hired an expert to advise him to this. But of course, what saved it for the nation was that it was actually one of the only probably three copies, and the other two were gone, there on the day. So it was actually there on the day in the Earl of Kent's back pocket. But how did Cecil get Elizabeth to sign the warrant in the end, the original warrant? He told them that the Spanish Armada had landed in Wales in February 1587. That's how he did it. He told her an absolutely whopping big lie. And actually that explains something that could never be explained, which is why, although Mary was executed in the conditions of the most absolute secrecy, the hue and cry in every county of England, that's the local sort of police force, if you like, was out in force, which doesn't make any sense at all. But of course, you can't have it both ways. If you say the Spanish Armada was landed, you've got to have the hue and cry out. So that explains that. And that was how he did it. And in fact, after he told Elizabeth this, he'd got the warrant already, he'd already worked out, he'd already written the thing, it was all ready to just leave the signature. And Elizabeth does send her the warrant, and she calls for it, and she has a look at it. She thinks about it, and then she signs it. And then she has another think about it, and she tells her secretary, Davidson, not to let it out of his possession until she gives the okay. Although he can show it to Walton, who's sick, embedded in his house in Windsor Lake, because this is Elizabeth of Clujeaux. That means she thinks that the mere sight that she's actually signed the warrant will kill him. The shock will be so great, it'll kill a terrible joke. But Davison is not to let it out of his possession. And of course, the minute he's out of the room, there he says, hand it over, and takes it to him. And there's a special meeting of the Privy Council, not in the Privy Council chamber, but in Burley's private apartment, which decides to send the warrant and not to tell Elizabeth until the deed is passed. Of course, the next day, Elizabeth says she's not sure about this, has it gone yet? And she had it back. Of course, then it's too late when she wants it, but she says she's had a dream. And in fact, she had a bad dream, Mary was dead and all this. Her story is that she was so upset by this dream, she had to get Dorothy Stafford, who was, one of her gentlewomen basically to come into bed with her because she couldn't, she was too upset to sleep. Actually, Elizabeth is playing a bit of a game here because, as you know, or if you don't know, now, Elizabeth also wrote to Mary's jailer saying, can't you just get rid of her by, just smother her, just get rid of her in the night by Richard II of Pontefract, just assassinate her. Why? Because it's the difference between a private assassination and an act of state for which she is accountable to God. In other words, if it's a private assassination, it's not a regicide, quite in the same way. Or at least it's not a regicide by act of state. And that's what Elizabeth is concerned about. By the time we got to 1587, Elizabeth is aware that Mary is a problem that she's not going to be able to solve. And she, with great reluctance, she is willing to sign off on the thing. Although I have to say that executing Mary is Elizabeth's armada of the soul. Because, of course, it destroys her ideal of a divine right. done as you want. This is the last thing that she actually wants to do. But by then, things are dangerous. I mean, the armada will come. There was talk there was going to be a Spanish armada, also a separate French armada funded by the Guise, you know, coming out of the channel ports and so on. So, I mean, Mary, Elizabeth exacts reprisals, because, of course, I mean, it was the... I mean, to take the warrant and send it when she, you know, basically said, not to say until I go, not to go until I say, rather, and then she calls it back. I mean, it is a sort of act of republicanism. I mean, it is a defiance of what she wanted, even if... I mean, they just thought they knew better, and they thought this was a dangerous situation, and they had to deal with it. But actually, it's put into a different light. It's probably not very accurate. It's a Dutch version of the execution done actually quite a bit later. You've probably seen it before, but it gives you some idea. I'm afraid the executioner was very incompetent and had to have three blows of three strikes before she was gone. But it has a slightly different take when you look at this, because actually this is almost like a film script. It's like a script for the whole thing. And it was written by William Cecily in 1559, 2 years before Mary ever went back to Scotland. And it's actually a plan, his plan for restoring Scotland to what he called the ancient wheel, or what he believed to be the ancient wheel, the ancient condition. And this is the very last paragraph. And finally, if the Queen, that's Mary, who of course is Queen of Scots, even though she's got a regent ruling in Scotland in 1559, if the Queen shall be unwilling to this, and what in fact appears above is that Scotland shall be ruled by a council of 24 nobles. That Mary will actually effectively abdicate in favour of, or become a figurehead in favour of, a council of 24 nobles. And it'll be like the Venetian Senate. She'll be like a Doge of Venice, if you like. Scotland will be governed by, if you like, a council. Almost like, if you like, you know, the Dutch were after the Dutch Revolt, or Venice is, you know, by a Doge and a council. If the Queen shall be unwilling to this, as it is likely she will, in respect of the greedy and tyrannous affection, the tyrannous, again, you know, think of not tyranny, the tyrannous affection of France, then is it apparent that Almighty God is pleased to transfer from her the rule of the kingdom for the weal, for the good of it. And in this time must be used great circumspection to avoid the deceits and trumperies of the French. And then may the realm of Scotland consider being once made free, what means may be devised. Then may the realm of Scotland consider being once made free, what means may be devised through God's goodness to accord the two realms to endure forever at the pleasure of the Almighty, in whose hands the hearts of all princes be. And this really tells us what Cecil's, you know, sort of complicated English, but it tells you what Cecil's scheme was. You get rid of Mary, you basically either force her to abdicate or you make her a sort of figurehead. You have a council of 24 Protestant nobles, and Scotland becomes a satellite of the English imperial monarchy. It becomes an orb in the English imperial crown. But what Cecil was after was, if you like, an Anglo-Scottish, not necessarily dynastic union, but an Anglo-Scottish religious unity in which basically you've got a Protestant Great Britain. That was his ticket. Religion came before monarchy. He actually says this. There's a couple of annotations that he makes in which he actually says that, you know, I'm the Queen's servant, but if push comes to shove, I'm God's servant first. It's a bit like Thomas More, except he's the Protestant God, rather than the Catholic God. But this was his, from 1559, from 1559 onwards, he wanted Mary written out of the script. It's absolutely extraordinary story that he saw that abdication was what, you know, should be before ever really she'd ever got home from France. And so he had a plan of attack all along. And this is actually quite early, this is 1562. This is how he imagines himself, and it's actually how he's represented. This is a design for his tomb in St. Martin's Church in Stamford, and this is how he appears you can actually go and see it, in his funeral monument here in St. Martin's Church. He's a Protestant chivalric knight. And the inscription on the tomb is that, you know, what he did for Elizabeth was that basically he protected the Queen's safety and the security of the state. the Queen's safety and the security of the state. He's probably the first person in English history, in the English language, to talk about state security. And what state security meant was the Protestant state. And what it meant was, I was the guy that cut off the head of the Queen of Scots. But of course, he wanted this to go down into history. You know, he'd already laid down something, the paper trail, Robert Beale was busily collecting everything that was necessary to this line of the story, the Cecil Walton line of the story, and putting it into a special archive in what became the Elverton Papers. But of course, after Mary was dead, Cecil then stopped being quite so radical. Now he becomes much more conservative. This is him in the 1590s. He loved his garden. He had, you know, the equivalent, if he lived today, he did have plants sent from South, rare plants sent from South America, which was absolutely amazing. Even during the war with Spain, he got rare plants sent from South America. This is a guy who would, you know, effectively have rare plants today flowing from Japan or, you know, wherever, you know, Indonesia or wherever he might be to push his garden. But here he had gout, so he went round his garden on a mule. But he also said, like Sir Winston Churchill in a different century, that history will be kind to me because I intend to write it. And he then commissions the Cecil Zachary Commission, William Camden, to write the history of Elizabeth's reign, in which the Cecils are getting to appear, you know, in a sort of big time. Actually, I have to say that Camden was quite a, on the whole, he was a reputable, he was probably the first more scientific historian. He wasn't entirely scientific, but he was, you know, pretty scientific by the standards of the age. Much. In other words, he didn't just make things up. He slanted a bit, but he didn't actually make things up. And I mean, to his great credit, Camden, although I think this was really not known at all, and I didn't find it out by the time I did the book. I might have done it, I didn't have it in the book. Camden, as well as writing the annals of the reign of Elizabeth, also wrote anonymously, not under you know, no name, he wrote a true history of Mary Queen of Scots, which was actually not surprisingly favourable to the Queen and contains many of the things that it turns out were very similar to things that I've talked to you about this evening. So this is an absolutely extraordinary tale. I mean, what's the sort of the lesson from it? Well, I suppose, we know an awful lot more, at least I think we know an awful lot more about Mary Queen of Scots. And of course, I'm not saying that, you know, mine is going to be the definitive version. There are no definitive versions, and it would be trawled over, you know, I mean, probably another 1,000 times, you know, in the next 400 years. But I think that if I can say so, sort of modestly, I think that the one thing that will never change is that we will now see who the enemy was. Mary's enemy. Mary's enemy was never really Elizabeth, it was William Cecil. Thank you very much. Thank you. Well, I mean, you know, now I find out what you really wanted to know. Yeah.
First question. Elizabeth was so reluctant to design Mary's death warrant, right? Repeatedly.
Yeah.
Do you think she was by finally signing the Duke of Norfolk?
Yes.
She, in her mind, was making up for, or
yeah.
That was going to replace.
Possibly a little bit of a struggle. Elizabeth was rather reluctant to sign death warrants.
Yeah.
And by the way, this wasn't the only time they pulled this trick. Mm-hmm. About 10 years ago, I made a BBC, made a four-part series for Docs called Renaissance Secrets, and one of them was on the Lopez plot. I wanted to look into this, and I researched, and I write the Lopez plot up before too long. Not as a full length thing, just a chapter, and so something I'm going to do next on last year's Elizabeth. And in fact, Lopez, you know, had never planned to poison Elizabeth. Lopez, in a nutshell, Lopez had got sort of caught out between two core factions, both peddling intelligence. And he had offered to poison Elizabeth by putting poison into her syrup, but Elizabeth didn't drink syrup. It was a standing joke that she didn't drink syrup. And if he said, you know, I mean, she knew straight away that if he said that, he was just going to get a bit of cutting the King of Spain out of, you know, whatever it was, you know, 10,000 crowns or whatever. Well, wonderful, good luck to him. You know, that wasn't the problem. But Lopez had to go because he was then the man that knew too much about something else that the Cecils were up to. This is the essence of it. Lopez knew that William, that the Cecils, which were, had started peace talks with Spain when they were not supposed to. So he had to go. And again, Elizabeth wouldn't sign the death warrant. And they managed to get him executed without one by a complicated legal manoeuvre. Basically, he was in the jurisdiction. He was in the tower. He was in the tower. And Elizabeth had written to the lieutenant of the town and said, however many warrants come or however many things, you don't, he's not to go. He's not to be left. He's not to be killed. And what they did was they moved him across the river to Southwark to a different jurisdiction and then went back to the King's Bench and, you know, started another case. And then basically, it went through on the rations. And again, Elizabeth only found out after the, you know, so it wasn't the first time they'd done this. But Elizabeth was not quick at signing death warrants. She was wary of it. No, I think Elizabeth didn't rush into anything, actually, in that way. So, but then, you know, you might say these were dangerous times. And, you know, actually, Professor Alford, he has a slightly different take to, he has a very similar take on Cecil, except it's focused differently. You know, Cecil always believed that he was protecting Elizabeth from herself, and he sort of goes with that line. Mm-hmm. Whereas I sort of go with the line that he was working behind her back on things that. But then, you see, you mustn't overplay this, because I know what you're going to ask me next. You're going to ask me why she didn't sack him. That's the obvious follow-up. Yeah. I get that asked that quite a lot. And the answer to that is very, very easy. Who were you going to put in his place? Mm-hmm. He was on her side, even if he was too much on her side. Mm-hmm. He was on her side. Who else would you put in the place? Well, who was the obvious candidate? Who was the intelligent guy who was a master, you know, master draftsman and a master bureaucrat who could have done all of this, you know, with his hands tied behind his back? And it's Henry Howard, mm-hmm. the son of the Duke of Norfolk, yes. Mm-hmm. It's Henry Howard, the future, you know, big shot in the Earl of Northampton and James the First Reign. Mm-hmm. He could have done it, but of course, his religion was in his father's, you know, his religion stood in the way. Henry Howard is probably the source of various sort of leaks of finished bits to Mary's, to people like John Wesley, Bishop of Ross, and to the 1560s, 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 you know, within that circle. And also, there's another thing, too. You also have to remember that Elizabeth and Cecil went back a long way. There was nothing romantic. There was never anything romantic in that relationship, quite unlike others. They went back a long way, right to, you know, right back, obviously, to even, well, I mean, right back to Edward VI and right back to Somerset's time, you know, sort of Thomas Seymour affair and all the rest of it. But remember, they both have something on each other. They both have something on each other. They conformed to Catholicism to stay alive in their children's realm. You know, Mary had, Elizabeth had conformed, maybe under a bit of protest, but she had conformed to the nest. You know, one time she was at Woodstock with Benito. And Cecil, to just keep his head on, had had a great high mass in Wimbledon Church on Easter Day, of, you know, whatever it was, 1556, I think, Easter Day 1550, had a great high mass, and all his family had gone, and he'd made sure to do it, having gone on a sort of special trip to London in a barge to collect all the special creams and oils and the wafers and the wine and all the rest of it. And he'd actually been on the day just to be sure that everybody knew he'd effectively called in Sky TV and let's put a broadcast of them. I think that's the reason. But I mean, she caught him out. She caught him out over the subsidy bill. She caught him out over the, you know, the business with the grains. I think she was furious with him, you know, and every now and then she would tell him, you know, you do that again and you're out. To get out of the Warren business, he just lied. He said Davidson was lying and he wasn't. He had never asked for it when he came out. He knew nothing about it. He just lied because they still wouldn't speak to him for 6 months. But you see, what was she to do? But you see, when you see it in this frame, see, you have to, if you see it in this, you take it out of the frame that you thought you knew and you put it into a frame in which rank does not trump gender, what you then see is that a woman monarch is up against it. And a woman monarch who doesn't marry into her succession is doubly up against it. Because, you know, in a way, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. If you don't marry into her succession, you're a problem. You're deeply irresponsible. The country is potentially quite unstable. I quite often get asked by students, did the religious Elizabethan religious settlement settle anything? My answer to this is now, how could it when the succession wasn't settled? You didn't know what was coming next. You know, people are looking for the next one. Elizabeth was quite right about that. But if Elizabeth had married, what then? You know, she could have ended up like Mary in the sex scandal. Or like Jane Grey, you know, some ghastly man saying, well, I'm the king now, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and actually, I debated this, didn't I? I debated this in Westminster Abbey with Antonia Fraser and I think Derek Wilson on Radio 4. And we debated this question, and actually Antonia, who I have a lot of respect for, it's a point of view, but she thought, oh no, Dudley would have been fine, he would have behaved, and he would have been, well, I think he was the popinjay. Mm-hmm. He would have, the minute he got there, he was the Dudley, the minute he got there, he would have started doing things on his own, and that was not in Elizabeth's way. I've just written this, the Duke of Ferrier's dispatch at the beginning, at the end of Mary's reign, when he went to see Elizabeth at Botley Hall, just a few days before Mary died, you know, he said, you know, she's going to be governed by, and I know that she's determined to be governed by nobody. And, she was, in the end, she would have married, if Leicester hadn't been married, if Dudley hadn't been married, and there hadn't been the whole Amy Robsart scandal, I think she probably would have married him. And then, if that had happened, we would then know the rest because it would be history. So we would actually know the answer to that conundrum. But actually, in a way, I think she got it right. She didn't marry. She didn't put herself under the jurisdiction of the man. But on the other hand, I'm afraid in terms of dynastic monarchy, that was deeply irresponsible. And I'm quite upset. There's a big shot Radio 4, sort of national radio program over here called In Our Time, which is sort of impresario by fronted by Melvin Bragg, who's a hot shot culture person, and we did the death of Elizabeth and the takeover of James. And now I really threw him by saying Elizabeth, by not setting the session, she was deeply irresponsible. And he was the first deeply to really quite get his head around this. Because the other panelists thought, no, it's deeply irresponsible. It's what in the dynastic one, he needs to settle the succession. But of course, she couldn't do it. And that was what she wanted to do. I think she wanted to leave the monarchy in the same state that it had been when Henry had left it to her, to her siblings. She wanted to leave it, which of course she couldn't. And it was the gender thing more than anything else that prevented her. But actually, probably the choices that she, it's one of the, she's in a vice. Whatever choice she makes is wrong. She probably, in the end, she probably did make the right choice, actually. Though I might not have said that when I first finished this book. Mm-hmm. I also now think that she was probably the greater queen by having to overcome all these obstacles with all these men. She was probably the greater, because of that, because actually it wasn't the case that because she was queen, people just think because she's queen, she could get things done. She couldn't get things done just because she was queen. Everything was like trench warfare.